Ladies and gentlemen, we are on Daf Yud Dalad Amud Aleph 14a1. Now, we started this last time, but I think we'll start it, we'll go over it again. And I wanted to take us to the issue that becomes a central issue for a good number of pages following here. I don't want to follow it throughout the entire discussion. I just want to take the first part of it and then we'll skip to the next Mishnah. You remember this from last time. Shochet b'Shabbat uv'Yom Kippurim. If one slaughters an animal on Shabbat or on Yom Kippur, even though were a person to do this, and were a person to do it with intent, that person would be obligated to, it would be a capital crime, you could get the death penalty for it. Still, shchitato kshera, the shchita is kosher. Okay? So we are seeing a variety of circumstances where you might have thought the shchita isn't okay. And here is a different kind of a circumstance. This is a circumstance where we're not doubting the quality of the shchita. We are simply raising a problem with it, which is that it's done at a time when you're not allowed to do shchita. So, is the shchita still valid? The answer is that the shchita is still valid. Right? If it was done correctly, it was done correctly, and it doesn't matter whether you are not allowed to do it. The only thing that matters is that it was done correctly. Okay? That we established last time. Now let's go into the Gemara. Amar Rav Huna Darash Chiyabar Rav Mishmei Darav. Chiyabar Rav Darash means interpreted now in the name of Rav. Asura Ba'achila Liyom. The Gemara says that even though this Shchita is kosher, still it is prohibited to eat the animal throughout the day until the end of the day, until the day is over.
Shabbat, okay. And you cannot cook anymore.
Well, so you, in Shabbat, you cannot cook, but you could eat it raw. Right? You could. You don't want to eat it raw, that's you. But people could eat it raw, but raw meat, I mean, it's done. It's done. Okay, or shchita is even could be taken in a more general sense. You can't go fishing on Shabbat. Okay, I went to a restaurant today where I'm sure I had raw fish. It was sushi. The sushi is a raw fish. Okay, so we eat raw fish. I used to be with a family, I remember, where the kids would always eat raw hamburgers. What is it called?
Steak tartare.
Steak tartare, that's what it's called?
Yeah.
Okay, so that dignifies it. Maybe the French name.
Very French.
Exactly. So, if the shchita is performed on the Shabbat, not supposed to do it, but you've done it. Right? Even though you might be able to eat it, if it were eaten raw, still you're not allowed to eat it, says Rav here, until Shabbat is over. Until the Shabbat is over. Yep.
Perhaps you're supposed to salt and soak it, and so there's no blood, so that doesn't necessarily mean we have to cook it.
Correct. So the salting and the soaking, that's permissible, might be permissible on Shabbat. It's a question about whether it is in fact permissible in this circumstance, but in theory it might be. It might be. Because you can surely wash things on the Sabbath. You know, if you have a piece of food and it falls on the floor and you want to eat it, you can wash it and clean it off.
But don't you have to then... That you couldn't prepare
anything.
Yeah, don't you have to then eat it on Shabbat if you... Yeah. Oh yeah, right.
What's that?
If you're not allowed to do it. If you're going to soak it and salt it on Shabbat, but you're not allowed to prepare food for anything other than on Shabbat.
Maybe, but let, forget, you're adding additional levels of complexity to the question. Let's not make it more complex than it is already. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do it. Only question is it kosher? So it says, yes, it's kosher, but you can't eat it until after the Sabbath is over. V'nashbin chavraya l'meimar. And the sages then tried to figure out the reasoning behind Rav. As Rav says, well, it's kosher, you can't eat it till after the Sabbath is over. So they said, why? Why do you have to wait till after the Sabbath is over? Okay? V'nashbin chavraya l'meimar. And an explanation of Rav's teaching, the scholars in the academy thought to say, Rabbi Yehudahi. They concluded that Rav's reasoning was a result of a position taken by Rabbi Yehuda. So then the Gemara obviously asks, hey Rabbi Yehuda, which Rabbi Yehuda? As to say, what teaching of Rabbi Yehuda are you talking about? Right? So they concluded it's Rabbi Yehuda's teaching that Rav goes according to, but you can't eat it until after the Sabbath is over. So they asked, which one? What's the issue here? Amar Rabbi Abba. Rabbi Abba says, Rabbi Yehuda dahachanahi. This is the view of Rabbi Yehuda as far as the preparation of something for the Sabbath. Ditnan, because it is taught in the Mishnah, Nechavchin et adiluin mipnei abehima. We may cut up gourds before an animal on the Sabbath for the animal to eat. That's not really relevant to our issue. The next one is what's relevant. And we can cut up a nevela in front of dogs. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Im lo hayta nevela me'erev Shabbat, Asura, Letisha ina mina muhan, because it is not something that was prepared for the dogs to use. Alma kevan devlam itchahan. Therefore, since it was not prepared me'et mol from the day before, Asura, hachinam. Here too in the Mishnah the same thing applies. Since it wasn't prepared from the day before, it is forbidden to eat it on the Shabbat. Okay, let's go over this and see what it's talking about. We made reference to this last time, that according to the laws of the Sabbath, and there is some variation of the rabbis in terms of the stringency of the law as they will interpret it, and Rabbi Yehuda is among the more stringent of the interpreters, things that are done on the Sabbath, including things that are eaten on the Sabbath, have to be in a state where they could have been eaten before the Sabbath in order for them to be eaten on the Sabbath. Okay? If something was in a state at the onset of the Sabbath, which would not allow it to be used on the Sabbath, then in fact it cannot be used on the Sabbath. Okay? So here in the example that he uses, if we have a nevela, an animal died of its own causes, whatever it is, okay? It says here in the Mishnah that you're allowed to cut up the animal and feed it to the dogs. Okay? That means that you, a Jew, are actually using this thing on the Sabbath. Okay. However, if the nevela occurs on the Sabbath, before the Sabbath, you couldn't cut up this animal. The animal was a live animal. Okay? When it is on the Sabbath, and suddenly the animal dies, according to Rabbi Yehuda, this animal is mukzeh. It is set aside. It cannot have been prepared for the Sabbath because before the Sabbath it was living. The fact that it dies on the Sabbath means that suddenly its state and its possibility changes. Rabbi Yehuda says the only way you can use something on the Sabbath is if before the Sabbath it was usable on the Sabbath. And in fact, that animal was not usable on the Sabbath. Question.
Doesn't seem like there was any human action that occurred on the
Sabbath. Doesn't have to be. Doesn't have to be any human action. Doesn't have to be. It can be an action just of nature. Okay? If something happens in nature that creates a new reality, can we take advantage of that reality on the Sabbath? According to Rabbi Yehuda, we cannot. You're not allowed. Everything on the Sabbath must have been prepared before the Sabbath. It's a stringent position. Rabbi Yossi takes a very different position. In the Talmud in Masechet Shabbat, Rabbi Yossi takes the much more lenient position that is permissible. Okay? So that's a classic issue in Halacha, is the dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi as far as Mokzeh goes. Okay?
Specifically this question of
Mevela? No, just it's a general question. It's a general question in many areas of Mozart. Okay.
What about
choked? Okay.
I mean, that's something that cooks overnight, doesn't it? Does it have to be edible before? And it's
you bet it has
after?
To. Yeah.
So you have to start it way before.
It has to be minimally edible. Minimally.
Oh, yes.
Doesn't have to be maximally edible. That is to say, doesn't have to be the way you want it to be. But it has to be minimally edible before the Sabbath.
So it's a finishing overnight.
You can finish, that's okay. That's okay, that's all right. When we made the challenge, we started it before Shabbat. We did this one year, is it, what, 2-3 years ago we did this? And so we started in the afternoon, we got the challenge going, and it kept going, right, until we ate it the next day, okay? You have to cook something a minimal amount before the Shabbat. You can't just turn it on.
What would Rabbi Yossi do with the
Shabbat? That's okay. Rabbi Yossi's the liberal one. And Rabbi Yehuda also. Rabbi Yehuda is also okay. As far, oh, you mean would he say you could cook? No. It's also a problem because you can't cook on the Sabbath. It's not an issue of muktzah. Here the issue is a muktzah issue because it's been a change of status. It was more complicated when you raised the question of cooking, because that independently is prohibited on the Sabbath. So the question is, what is the definition of cooking? Right? Is the definition of cooking any cooking? Because you could say the definition of cooking could be heating something up. It's possible. You know? Could be making something that's medium, cooked medium, well done. I don't know. What's the definition of cooking? You tell me.
And what about marinating today?
Correct. Marinating is also, because marinating is a form of cooking. Marinating is an issue of cooking.
Without heat. Well, maybe it makes it
well, but it can... the question is, that do you need heat to cook? There are several other things. Marinating is one of them. Salting could be one of them. Salting is a way of cooking. Some say that salt is a way of cooking things. So, but that's cooking, okay? Here, we're talking about the nevela that didn't exist before the Shabbos. Right? Didn't exist before the Shabbat. Suddenly, the nevela exists on the Shabbat. Okay? Now, realize that our Mishnah has said to us, HaShochet b'Shabbat, if somebody performs Shechita on Shabbat, okay? And the Shechita is done on the Shabbat. Before the Shabbat, the animal couldn't have been eaten. So it's a little bit like the nevela for the dog, but it's a shechita for a person. So therefore, we can't eat the shechita, we can't eat it on the Sabbath. Because before the Sabbath, it had to have been prepared. So at least maybe our Mishnah goes according to Rabbi Yehuda. The same concept here, Rabbi Yehuda, that which is used on the Shabbat has to have been prepared and ready before the Shabbat. Minimum. Yes?
I get the feeling that whether something is used on the Shabbat is good or bad, depends on the physical act of Shkita. All the things that we're talking about today have to do with the Shabbat restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, it seems to me that the Shkita is the Shkita.
Shkita.
Shkita is done correctly.
It's correct. Then it's kosher.
It's good.
Correct.
All the time.
Correct. So that was the point of the Mishnah. What we are now discussing is something that is not directly relevant to the point of the Mishnah, but that's the way the Gemara works.
It's not relevant to the Shkita. It's relevant to Shabbat.
It's relevant to Shabbat, correct. That is correct. Yes?
I want to go back to the Nevela. So we have suddenly on Shabbat a Nevela. Okay. I'm not allowed to give it to the dogs because I didn't prepare it from Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But the dogs are hungry. They want to eat it.
It's too bad.
They cannot go and eat the Nevela.
Oh, they could eat it, but you can't cut it up.
So why is an argument? It's a farm. They go to eat. I mean,
The dogs, you can't say to the dogs, it's Shabbos.
You don't need to say that. You don't go and eat it. That's
but generally speaking, people take care of their dogs, and they don't like their dogs to just peck at dead animals. They cut them up. So the question is, can you prepare the thing, cut up the animal for the dog? That's the only issue.
Should I stop from the dogs to go?
No, you can. You don't have to worry about it. The dog can do it at once.
So it's
okay. Don't worry about it. Okay. Now, you would think that this is enough of an answer that we figured out that the Mishnah goes according to Rabbi Yehuda. But the Gemara is not satisfied with that. The Gemara will not be satisfied with this at all. Abaye now raises problems with this. Amar le Abaye, mi dame. Are the two cases comparable? Namely, we have two cases in front of us here. We have the case of somebody who is a shochet on Shabbat. The shechita is done on Shabbat. That's case number one. Then we have another case, which is a case of the nevela that's cut up for the dogs. So he says, are these two cases comparable? Right? We're learning from one about the other. And the Baya says they're not comparable. Midame. Are the two cases really comparable? Hata meikara mucham liadam. There, as far as the carcass cut up is dog food. Mucham liadam. Before the Shabbat, I'm going to tell you that animal was prepared for a human consumption, Abaye says it's not true that animal before the Shabbat is not prepared. It is not prepared for animal consumption, maybe, but it's perfectly prepared for human consumption. But you'll say it had to be shechted beforehand. No, I'm not telling you it has to be shechted. All I'm telling you is that it has to be an animal. Why do you have a sheep in the first place? You want it for wool. Right? I'm a farmer who shechts my sheep, and I like to have lamb. Okay? So I grow my sheep. I have a certain variety that I grow for lamb. So you mean to tell me that animal is not prepared before the Sabbath? The whole reason why I have that animal is shechita. That's the only reason why I have it in the first place. So, indeed, the case that you gave me originally of the animal that dies on the Shabbat, that is an odd case. I agree with you there, says Abaye. Okay? Because there's a change in the status of the animal and the options available for the animal. Suddenly the animal dies. And a limited option then, because it's not fit for human consumption, it's only fit for animal consumption. But he says, you can't say that. You can't compare that to the normal case of a normal animal, assuming this is a kosher animal. Because I bought the animal, I have the animal in the first place for the sake of shechita. Right? So it's not really changing its status at all. Yeah, I'm shechting it, but that's why I had it in the first place. Okay? So yeah, that's what's more complicated. So you can't really compare this. Bahashta mucha michlabim. Now, first he's talking about the case of the animal that dies. Before the Sabbath, it wasn't of any value for the animals, for the dogs. Bahashta mucha michlabim. Now, it's ready for dogs. Now it's okay for dogs. Okay? Hence it makes sense to classify the carcass as mukhtseh. That's the article interpretation, which is correct. But we can conceive of that carcass as being mukhtseh because a real change occurred in the status of that and the options that we had with the animal. Haha, here, namely in the Mishnah, meikara mukhan liadam. From the beginning, this animal was prepared for a human being. That's the only reason I own it. I own it for a human being. The hashta mukhan liadam. On the Sabbath, it's still prepared for a human being. Okay?
Well, didn't we talk about the law where you're not allowed to eat a living being?
Yeah.
So that means it's not
there. Not completely prepared, but it's pretty prepared. Namely, that I had it, I owned it for that purpose. Right? It's a question of my purpose. You're right, there are things I can't do with it. Or there are things that I have to do in order to make it edible. Right? But Abaye is simply saying that this is not a case of mukhtseh. It's not a case of mukhtseh. You got other problems, it's true. You got other problems. And the Gemara is going to go on and figure out, well, what are those other problems? What could it be? This is not a case of mukhtseh. You told me that it's Rabbi Yehuda. Remember, what we're trying to figure out is why you have to wait until Saturday night to eat the shechita. So the Gemara's first possibility here is that this is a case of mukhtseh. And here, that's what it first opined when it said that, it's mukhtseh. And now Abaye says it's not a case of mukhtseh. There are other problems, but it's not a case of mukhtseh. Right. Now the argument goes back to Rabbi Abba. He's the one who said it is Moshe. Okay? You know what I said? It is Moshe. So let's see how he defends that. Misvarat behema b'chayeha la'achila omedet. This is what you said before, Mark, almost. He says, how can you think that a behema, while it is living for the purpose of eating it as food? Behema b'chayeha legadel omedet. The purpose of an animal is not for food, but to increase and to have other animals. Or, as you said before, the purpose of your sheep is wool. You just said to me that this is not a case of mukhtseh. I'm going to tell you it is a case of mukhtseh. Why? Because the purpose of that animal was wool and not shechita. Okay? And therefore, if the purpose of holding an animal generally is either something other than shechita, or it can be shechita and five other things, then you are really performing a transformation when you are designating it for the purpose of shechita. Right? So here now we have two possibilities. We have one possibility. The first one was that the purpose of an animal is for shechita, and therefore it's not a case of mukhtseh, because before the Sabbath the purpose is shechita, on the Sabbath the purpose is shechita. We haven't made a change in the status of the animal. Now we have possibility number two. Possibility number two is, before the Sabbath, the purpose of that animal was ligadel, animal husbandry, right? To increase the number of animals that I have, to grow further animals. Comes the Sabbath, and I decide to shech the animal, that is a case of mukhtseh, okay? Because I've changed the status of the animal. That is a third possibility. What's the third possibility? That the purpose of the animal might be for wool, and it might be for shechita. Well, that's a different. That's possible. That was the original assumption, but that's what Abaye argued against. argue. Abaye doesn't agree with that. Okay? Okay, let's go on. We'll take the third one in the text. You'll see. Mi svarat behema bechayeha la'achila omedet, behema bechayeha la'gadel omedet. That was the second one. Okay? Now, Abaye then counters. And Abaye says, Iache, if what you say is so, behema l'Rabbi Yehuda b'yom tov, hechi shachatina. He raises now another possibility. And this involves the case of Mutze on a Yom Tov. Right? We are now talking about Yom Mutze on the Sabbath. But here is a slightly different and more complicated case because of the laws of the Yom Tov. Yeah. Let's see if it explains it here. The Yom Tov Hechi Shachtina. How, according to Rabbi Yehuda, could we permissibly slaughter animals on the Yom Tov? The slaughtered meat would be classified as mukzah, and this in turn should render the very act of slaughter impermissible. Now, here what you have to know is that there is a difference between the laws of Shabbat and the laws of Yom Tov. There is an essential difference between the Sabbath and Yom Tov. And that difference is that according to the Torah, you are allowed to cook on the Yom Tov, but you're not allowed to cook on the Sabbath. Cooking is prohibited on the Sabbath. So the Torah says, Ochel Nefesh, food for the self, is permissible on Yom Tov. Okay? If cooking is permissible on Yom Tov, then other things that are relevant to cooking also, according to rabbinic law, are permissible on the Yom Tov. Well, what is very basic to cooking your chicken? Is shechting a chicken. Okay? So according then to halacha, on the Yom Tov, you could perform a shechita. You could perform a shechita. Okay? Because you're allowed to cook on the Yom Tov. However, you just told me that a purpose of an animal is its wool or to grow other animals. If that were true, that the purpose of the animal were that, then it would be prohibited to shecht an animal on the Yom Tov. Why? Because then, in fact, the purpose of an animal would be for some other purpose than cooking. And the animal would become muktzah on the Yom Tov. Right? Unless I have yet now a third possibility, which is that there could be two purposes for an animal. Right? First, I said the purpose of an animal was food. Then I said the purpose of the animal was something other than food, growing animals. And now I have the problem of the Yom Tov. If it's the purpose of an animal is growing animals, then how could I permit shechita on the Yom Tov? And we know that the law permits shechita on the Yom Tov. Right? So that's the next possibility here. Nishchata, Amar lo, Rabbi Abba says to him, Omedet la'achila, an animal, before the Yom Tov, omedet la'achila, may be eaten. It is there for the purpose of eating. Ve omedet legadel, and it is equally there for the purpose of growing. So that either one, if you go one way or you go the other way, both of them are possible. Okay? Nishkata, if the animal is slaughtered, huvrara de la achila omedet. If we slaughter the animal, then that is proof that the purpose of the animal was food. Okay? And, on the other hand, lo nishkata, if we do not slaughter the animal, Huvrara de legadel omedet. Then that proves that retroactively we assume the purpose of the animal was propagation, to grow animals. And therefore, if it dies on the Yom Tov, depends on what happens to the animal. Okay? Now this is the Talmudic concept of Brera. Of Brera. This is a very interesting concept which comes up in several different places in the Talmud. That is to say, on the one hand, we make certain assumptions about a situation. We will say, for example, that the purpose of an animal is food. But the reality is that things can have multiple purposes. The question is, do we decide on the purpose of something before, or do we decide after? Do we decide on the basis of, in fact, what is done with the animal, what its purpose is? So that if the animal is slaughtered, in that situation we accept the fact that the purpose of an animal is slaughtering. If the animal is not slaughtered, then the same situation is such that we accept that the purpose of an animal is simply to propagate the animal. Okay? So that, interestingly enough, the decision is made after the fact, depending upon what we do, what the situation was before the fact. That's the interesting thing here. Okay? In fact, we know what the purpose of something is only after we see what happens to it. Because you may decide something else. You may decide that every action leads to a certain result. A leads to B. Okay? And we say that we know that A always has to lead to B. Here we are saying that in certain situations, B will lead to A. We do not know what A is until we see what B is. And B then leads to A. Yes?
Okay. So I consider this really alien to what I have always thought of as Jewish views of time.
Time, okay.
Because this seems to be the first example I know of where there is an implication of time going in reverse.
That's correct.
And to me, the single central theme of Jewish history is that time only moves in one direction.
Very good. Which is why Rabbi Yehuda rejects the concept of Brera. Rabbi Yehuda agrees with you. Rabbi Yehuda says you cannot do this. And the question is a halacha question, who's right? He agrees with you, what you're saying. Let me give you another example first. I want to give you another example of Brera. This is in the laws of Erevin. You know that there are many laws about where you're allowed to walk on the Sabbath. Okay? You cannot walk from one domain to another, from the private to the public. Let's say you're out in the country. You're out in the country. There's even a limit to how far you can walk out in the country. Okay? 2,000 amot. Now, you can walk further than that if you make a special erev.
You need to put a bread something.
Right. You put some bread. And then you use bread and some salt, and you can put it further on, and then you have 2,000 amot from there. Okay? So you can extend the amount that you could possibly walk. That's what you do.
You do that before Shabbat.
Yeah.
Before Shabbat. You can do this before Shabbat, correct. So you create, there's a natural limit. It's called Chum Shabbat. It is the Sabbath limit. But you can extend the limit if before the Sabbath you put a meal in that place. That becomes your domicile, as it were. It's a legal fiction. And then you extend your limit beyond that. Okay. So listen to this. I'm reading to you now from the 8th chapter of Maimonides in his summary of the laws of Erevin. Okay? Halakha 1. one may not deposit two eruvim, one in the west and one in the east, so that one will be able to walk for a portion of the day in the direction of one of the eruvim, and then to rely on the second eruv for the remainder of the day. The rationale is that one may not make two eruvim for a single day. Okay? So if you have an eruv, right, you can't say, I have two eruvim. Okay? I'm going to do one in this direction, I'm going to do one in that direction. Okay? So therefore, I have two eruvim. You have to have one eruv. If a person erred and established two eruvim in two different directions, okay, because he thought that this was permitted, or he told two people to establish an eruv for him, and two different people do it, and they don't talk to each other. So he ends up with two eruv. And one established an eruv to the north, and one established an eruv to the south, he may only walk in the area common to both of them. So in other words, he can't take advantage of the fact that he now has two eruv. Okay? So you understand so far the situation. Now, listen to the next one. It is permissible for a person to establish two eruvim in two opposite directions and make the following stipulation. If tomorrow there is a mitzvah or necessity that arises and requires me to walk in this direction, then it is this eruv that I'm relying on. And the other eruv is of no consequence. If, by contrast, it is necessary that I go in the other direction, the eruv in that direction is the one in which I will rely, and the first eruv is of no significance. That is based on the law of Brera. All right? You're not allowed to make two eruvim. But the question is, if you do make two eruvim, and you say, I'm only going to use one eruv, can you use that one eruv even though you've made two eruvim? Because after the fact, in fact, you've only used one of them. So that we are relying on the after the fact to establish the reality in the first place. Rather than establishing the reality that leads to the fact establishes the reality. Okay? So that's the nature of the question of Brera. Okay? And the question is that permissible in all circumstances? Rabbi Yehuda rejects the notion of Brera, and this is a constant argument in the Talmud about whether it is permissible to take into account the concept of Brera. Okay.
How the problem that I have with this concept of Brera is that how do you reconcile the whole concept of intent with Brera?
It seems to me
that intent is a very important concept.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And here, basically, you can take intent and throw it out the window.
Well, are you throwing it out the window, or are you saying my intent will be clear by what my actions are? Okay? I intend two possibilities. I'm not intending one possibility. Right? There are two possibilities that can happen here. Right? And I am only, in fact, going to do one, but I don't know which one. It will be clarified which one after the fact, not before the fact. Okay, so I intend two possibilities, but I will only do one of them.
Maimonides is requiring a statement that's kind of like a contingent forward statement. If the guy didn't write the statement and then something happened tomorrow that required him to go in one direction...
Because he's concerned about the issue of intent. That is correct. He wants you to put it up front.
So if the guy had a sheep and he said, you know, if I'm hungry tomorrow, I...
That's right. That's right. That would be the logical extension of what I just read to you from Maimonides in the case that we were talking about just now. You would say ahead of time, If I'm hungry, I'm going to eat the sheep. If I don't eat the sheep, it means that the purpose of the sheep was legadel. Okay? That's correct. That's correct.
In the issue of the Ruvim, if a person has the preparation, his responsibility for that specific preparation, I understand going one way or another. But if it's the community prepare the extension of the Tchum Moshav, am I allowed to go both ways, number one, both coming back and both east and west? Mm-hmm. And question number two on that level, if I want to make mitzvah shel bikur chulim, do I need to have the rubin?
Absolutely. Mitzvah makes no difference. And that's the way Maimonides phrased this, really clarified that, because he says, if tomorrow there is a mitzvah or a necessity that arises and requires me to walk in this direction or whichever direction, so he set it up to say the reason that I would do it is because it's a mitzvah for me to do. So the fact that there is a mitzvah doesn't mean that you don't have to have an Erev. It means that you can operate within the Erev.
And what happens if the community makes
that? That's different. That is true. That's a good point. It could be that the community creates borders, and then it changes the definition of the community. That's different.
And then I can go east
and
west.
Correct, because the community could do that. But just the way the community has got to decide where the community ends. Where is the end of a community? Okay? Because you could say the Erev extends just 2,000 amot from my house. That's not true. I could walk down to Battery Park. Because in fact, the whole, between my house into Battery Park is one community. Okay, yeah?
So on the light side, last summer, we were in Livingston, Montana, and it was Shabbat, and we were looking for something to do, so we walked down to the fairgrounds, and they were having a 4-H contest, and a variety of youths were raising different animals, and they were in the pens, and we walked into the barn that had the sheep, as we were talking about, and they all had names, and either the sheep were going to win a contest and then be slaughtered or not. And lo and behold, one little girl had named her two sheep lunch and dinner. So she had the idea that they were going to be
eaten. There you go.
Help
you
to think about it.
There you go. There you go. Perfect.
That's Fuzzy and Woolly.
The Fuzzy and Woolly, right.
Maybe they weren't lunch and dinner.
There you go.
Seems there's a very big difference between saying an animal, in this case, has two purposes, and as it was mentioned, you could say, well, if I'm hungry tomorrow, I'm going to slaughter it, and it will have been raised for food. If I don't need this animal for food, then I would have raised it for breeding or for wool, as opposed to saying, the empirical approach, which is what is raised here, which is, we know what you had in mind, even if you don't, by seeing what you did with it after the fact. And I think that's a very modern and reasonable approach to the problem. We do experiments because we don't know what's going on. We look at the result and we say, oh, well, now we know what was going on before we entered. It's not time going backwards, it's simply looking back from the end point and asking what happened, and sometimes you can say, well, now I know what happened at that point.
Pre and post probability.
You have to find some other evidence. So,
pre and post probability.
I don't find this idea of Brera so creepy. I think it's perfectly normal, actually.
Okay.
When you did that, isn't that just like an overfit? Look at what happened, and then you sort of backfit a story to tell you what explains the outcome. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's what actually caused it. It could have been some other random event.
Maybe it depends on the circumstances. This is a pretty straightforward matter. It's not what's the origin of the universe. I'm not trying to figure out here what happened at the Big Bang. We're trying to figure, was this sheep intended to be used for food? Well, obviously it was, because we ate it. That's about it. You're right.
You could take it in a lot of different directions. Greg, where were you going with that?
No, I was just responding to the idea.
Sometimes the data are not...
I understand the concept that they don't want you to take a free option, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're supposed to plan out what you're doing in advance.
Right.
And you're supposed to be sort of, to use the word intent on doing something and be forward-thinking.
Right.
And if you allow this sort of free raw concept, then you're basically letting people take free options.
Which is why Rabbi Yehuda doesn't like it.
Right, exactly.
That's why he rejects it. Right. Or another reason why he rejects it. Barry?
So I like Maimonides' attempt, because I think that it is quite different than the other example, because it is done in anticipation and sets out the two alternatives. To me, of course, the immediate weakness is you can easily imagine a situation in which he's sitting there on Shabbat and two people arrive simultaneously to tell him of either a mitzvah or a necessity that would take him in either direction.
To opposite direction.
And since I can easily imagine that, there's no way out for him at that point in the structure that he's created that would be consistent. He would then have to violate one or another aspect of what was essentially his vow. I think it reminds me a little bit, because we just did it for Pesach, when we renounce the hummus, and we are really careful to make sure that's done beforehand, and not just by implication by what we do after that. I mean, we have a very, very high level of need to prepare before things rather than to get a free ride based on what we do after. So I think it's a very dangerous, I think it's actually very dangerous to allow this. Now, I can understand it, because it's so hard to tell people's intent unless we have a formal structure like before Pesach, where we actually demand people commit to their intent, a priority.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably
I was going to say, there's something that's just very contrary to principles, and principles are that this is supposed to give a prescription for how you act, not an experiment to look back and say, I acted that way, therefore it must mean whatever. It gives you a clear path and clear delineation as to how you proceed in situations and how you proceed in the future. So I guess that's, you know, Barry's talking about looking back, you know, that direction, but I think it's more fundamental than that to it. You're not performing an experiment, gathering data, and then making a conclusion. Conclusions are made for you, and then you apply them so that you always have a direction to go in. So you don't have the option of creating your own experiment. You have all of the elements before to make this clear for you, so that you aren't gathering data.
But what if you have, given the circumstances of both these examples we have, you're really dealing with two permissible possibilities. They're not two things that are not permissible. Both of them are permissible, but they're not permissible at the same time. That's the difference. Okay? It's either this or that. But it could be this or it could be that. Okay?
We all have different. We're all confronted by
that. Correct. It seems to me that this is not so uncommon, where we have multiple options. There are multiple options that are, however, somewhat exclusive vis-a-vis each other. They are somewhat exclusive vis-a-vis each other, and we will really only know which the options are after we make choices, which will, in a way, change something fundamental because of the choices we eventually make.
Why does it change something fundamental? You made a choice, and as a consequence of the choice, you're going to live through that. You could argue you don't know what would be the consequences of the other option. option.
Correct.
You didn't live through it.
But once I have made the choice that I have made, I cannot go back.
Right.
And in fact, I've created a new reality, right? Which is almost, I've created something new that proceeds as well, because now that thing that I've done has a significance which frankly didn't have before I began.
So can I use a very uncomfortable analogy, but the one that comes to mind? So everyone says if a plane had a crash and you were supposed to be on a similar plane or that plane, and everyone emotionally, even though you know it's irrational, says, oh, I was so lucky I missed that plane.
Right.
Okay, that's what your argument reminds me of. But it doesn't make any sense.
The difference here is you can't undo. Argument. If you've made that commitment, you can't undo it then.
Great.
If you designated the animal for Shabbat, then on Shabbat you can't change your mind. But if you simply not, in other words, you've almost, you're avoiding the problem of Mitzvah, you're making that a retroactive choice. You're putting up the choice.
On Yom Tov, if I'm hungry, I'm allowed to make a Shechita.
Right.
But I'm not hungry and I'm freezing cold. Can I cut the wool and make a sweater? It's a brera.
Well, don't use brera as an Israeli would use brera.
my.
That's what you're using. Brera.
And by the way, both of them is for real livelihood, not to freeze or not to.
It could be that there are circumstances where you could do it. There's no question about it. But there's also a double effect. You might slaughter the animal and get two benefits from it. Okay? You can use the slaughtering of the animal for food, and you can also benefit from the skin of the animal.
I understand the cooking in this. I accept it.
Okay.
I want to know if you accept me making sweater.
No.
So why am I allowed to make the sweater only if I'm cooking?
What do you mean by making a sweater? Making a sweater is more complicated. Because when you make a sweater, you have to do numerous things. There are numerous activities.
What I'm trying to say is that this issue of brera for food on Yom Tov gives me the opening to do a lot of things on that level that usually I'm not allowed to do.
It might. And therefore, you're somewhat right in that there are certain things that could become permissible and that become acceptable as permissible. I'll give you an example. One of the things that you might be able to do on the Yom Tov in order to prepare food is to carry that food. In fact, it is permissible to carry on the Yom Tov, even though it is prohibited on the Sabbath to carry. Okay? Why? Because of the connection to Ochel Nefesh, to the preparation of food. Because that was considered to be one of the normal activities, that became an activity that was acceptable because it was part of the normal activity. I'm not saying it's your normal activity. I'm telling you in the development of the law, that was considered to be normal activity. Just because that is done, however, doesn't mean that you could do anything. For example, doesn't mean you could get in your car to go to the stockyard, wherever it is, because you say, well, since I can eat, I could do anything, right? I could get in my car, I could turn on the engine, I could go buy the gas, because you told me that it's permissible to do anything. I didn't tell you. So Shechita is permissible. Shechita is permissible. That we know. That's what the law says. Cooking is permissible. But the rabbis themselves didn't allow the law to go in all possible directions. They severely limited it. What its limits are, we know. Largely, carrying is the one that's most obvious. But it doesn't go to anywhere beyond that. Yes?
I guess the question is, why is she, is there so much leeway with Shechita? Why didn't they just say, well, if we're not permitting all of these things on Shabbat, okay, you know, we won't permit Shechita also. Obviously, Shechita is work.
oh, Shechita is not permitted on Shabbat. The question is, if it happens, can you use it? Okay? And we've established now that you can use it, but you can't use it until Saturday night. And the question that we have is, why? Why can't you, if you're going to go so far as to say you can use it, and it's not disqualified, it's not unkosher, why wait until Saturday night? So the reason that we have is that, in theory, because we said, well, it was muktzah before Shabbat. But at this point, we know that we're not sure that it was muktzah anymore. Because what we have, in a way, the end result, the bottom line of what we have done from our reasoning, is to say we thought it was muktzah to begin with, but now we're not so sure it was muktzah.
Well, but if you designated for svarah on Shabbat, and maybe svarah on Shabbat, you still can't eat it on Shabbat.
Right. Yes, and therefore, the reasoning that it was muktzah is not the right reason. That's all we know. We have to go on and find a better reason.
Yeah. I want to get back to the original.
To the bread? Okay,
so it seems to be an assumption that there's something inherently important about making a public commitment, public statement, a legally binding commitment, before doing anything. I don't see that the example that Barry had about selling chametz, which we do, as a public or as a legal transaction, and deciding about whether or not a sheep or a calf is going to be used for food. What if you say, look, this calf that we have here, we're going to have to slaughter it tomorrow, Yom Tov, if the in-laws come home from shul with us for lunch. If they're not, we're going to send it back and wait for it. This wouldn't make sense, because in the real world, as you pointed out, there are many options, and sometimes you make the decision. I don't know. I don't see any inherent value in announcing beforehand. A young man asks a woman out on a date, would you like to have a cup of coffee and take a walk in the park? My intention is to marry you, even though we've just met here. So I want you to know that. I don't. What is the point? It's not a bad idea. Should we get a look? But it's not. It's not the way the real world works.
What
were
you going to ask?
Well, no. Just I sort of agree, but stating it a little differently. Is it necessary or any kind of compulsion to freeze an intent at any particular time? Why not have the flexibility of changing your intent as you're going along? And if that is a rationale, then looking back to see the intent makes more sense, because then you have great freedom in having a flexible intent.
No, your point is well taken. It is true that in the halacha, particularly in the Sabbath laws, intent is a crucial question. It is in most legal systems, in most issues of law, intent is important in deciding culpability, but certainly in the Sabbath laws, where the Torah itself says that this is malechet machashevet, it is intentional labor, intentional malacha, whatever that is, we define those terms, and it becomes crucial, therefore, that in fact you have intent to perform an action that is an impermissible action. So as far as the Sabbath laws are, it's crucial. And then as far as muktzah goes, intent is crucial for muktzah. Because if you do not have intent, then something is excluded. You have to have intended its use on the Sabbath, not only that it might be usable, but it's intended to be used. And otherwise, it's muktzah. It's not permissible on the Sabbath. So intent is a very crucial thing. And that may be, you may be right in terms of the conclusion, then it makes a lot more sense to establish intent after the fact and not before the fact.
We've been talking about this as if each individual has the opportunity to have the option and have the intent and then have the ex post facto review. How do you reconcile that with the emphasis on community? And if you needed to have your minion,
Mm-hmm. So, and also it seems to me Judaism is a very interesting balance of individual, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, it's a balance among three, individual, family, collective, and then community.
Mm-hmm.
But here, your whole conversation so far
is about individual.
Is about individual.
That's correct. That's correct. I wouldn't want to extend the argument too far, because you're right. There could be mitigating factors where the community is involved. As you said before, if the community makes the errors, we're dealing with a certain different reality. But yes, insofar as what we're discussing now, that is a question of individual intent. And that is relevant as far as the law goes, because the individuals are commanded to observe the Sabbath. So it is relevant there. Yes, sir.
Where is the error?
It's all around.
All around.
The Erev goes, I'll tell you how to find it, is go on the website of one of two synagogues, Fifth Avenue Synagogue, that's the best one. Go on the website of Fifth Avenue Synagogue, and they've got a map of the Erev in Manhattan, and that's the easiest way to see it. And they keep that map up to date in terms of where the Erev is. Okay? It extends basically, it doesn't go all the way downtown, at least didn't as far as the last time I looked at the map, not relevant for me, so I haven't really checked it badly, but this whole area, the west side, are all part of the Erev. It doesn't go into Harlem, though. It'll only go right up to the area around Mount Sinai Hospital.
I think the issue of hospitality that was raised is a very interesting one, because hospitality has such a high level of requirement that it reminds me, when we were in Jordan, we were actually, our tour guide was a Bedouin. He talked about how his mother had to keep sheep, because if someone came and entered through the front of the tent, she would be obligated to sacrifice one of the sheep for a meal. And if they enter through another part of the tent, it doesn't incur that obligation. But that the issue of hospitality might trump the need to decide whether or not one would actually slaughter an animal in that society.
Yes.
It wouldn't be the individual's choice,
right,
necessarily.
It's a matter of custom. You have to abide by the custom.
Enormous social pressure.
Right.
So even if before Shabbat they intended that animal for wolves, if somebody shows up at the front door, all of a sudden that a plan might not be necessarily the one that they could follow.
I wanted to make sure you all knew that if you're interested in getting your live goat or your live sheep in the back of certain bodegas in Brooklyn, they do slaughtering in the back room. It's in the but it's going on right now in our city.
Well, you better believe it.
Yeah.
There's plenty of it. Plenty of that. And there's kosher street too.
Yeah, in back rooms.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that's about all I want to deal with of this. We'll skip now. We're going to go to 15B2. 15B2. All the material in between is simply discussion of the ramifications of this to the Sabbath laws. Okay. 15B2, the Mishnah. Mishnah on 15B2. Hashochet b'magal yad. If one slaughters an animal with the blade of a hand sickle, we're used to thinking about the knife of shechita. We saw shechita knives when the shochet was here, so we're used to thinking of it as a limited type of knife. Well, a sickle, you know, which is an item that is used for other purposes, still is permissible. You can use it for shechita as well. Bitzor, with a piece of flint. Now the assumption being here, of course, that all of these items are properly sharpened and that they can perform the kind of cut that's necessary in Shechita. Uvekameh, or with a reed, also a reed, similarly, reeds can be very sharp, and you can sharpen up a reed so that it is sharp enough to perform Shechita with. The Mishnah says, Shechitato kashera. If you do the Shechita with that, the fact that it's not the normal knife, but another kind of knife, it's okay. Slaughter is valid. Hakol shochatin, all slaughter. Uliolam shochatin, and they can always slaughter. Uvakol shochatin, and we can slaughter with anything. But we have to see what this means. Chutz mimagal katsir, with the exception of a harvesting sickle. Vehamegera, and a saw. Vaheshinayim, and teeth, probably meaning animal teeth. Rashi says there we're talking about the jawbone of an animal, where you take the jawbone of an animal and it has sharp teeth on it, and you could use, in theory, you could use one of those teeth as your knife. Mipnei shehen chonkin. Oh, I'm sorry. Or a nail, meaning a nail on a finger, a fingernail, or the nail on an animal's nail. When we talk about a jawbone, we're talking about teeth. We could take an animal's foot, though, that has claws on it, and the claws also could be very sharp. Or we could sharpen up the claws. Okay? Now, in those cases, the last cases here, the harvesting sickle, the saw, the animal teeth, or a nail, it is not permissible. Mipnei shehen chotkim, because these instruments strangle rather than cut. They strangle rather than cut. Let's take a look at the Rashi. Go over on to the right, to the Talmud page. Matnitin. This is down about two-thirds of the way on the page. You see a big Nem Taf Nun Yud. First Rashi is the Magal Yad, with a sickle, a hand sickle. This, I don't know what it is in French. He quotes the French here, Rashba, Balaz in French. V'yesh la shte piyot. It has two cutting edges. Achat chalaka, one is smooth, kesakin, like a knife. Yachat yesh ba pegimot, and the other one is serrated. It's serrated. So this is this magal yad, the hand sickle, actually has two different types of surfaces. And keep that in mind as we'll get to the Gemara. It's not simple here because there is one of those surfaces. The serrated surface would not be permissible. What's the problem with the serration? It will tear, right? And tearing is one of the prohibited activities that disqualifies the cut of Shechita. Okay? So that's the problem. Kol shochtin ubekol shochtin, which just is kulam mefaresh b'gmara. The Gemara is going to explain this. I'm still reading the Rashi. Magal katsir. This is a harvesting sickle. That's not permissible. Shekotzrin bahatvua. That is used for cutting grain. That's whatever the French is there. He quotes, he translates it into French. Haltzila, balaz. Shepigimoteha notot. Kulam letzad echad b'shipua. All of the, how do you say it? How would you describe this in English? It's serrated, but it's on an angle. It's notched, but it's worse than just notched. They're notched all on an angle. They're all on an angle. Okay, in one direction, correct. Migera, which we translated here as saw. As a saw. Sakin a knife malepegimot, filled with serrations, I would say. The ein mishupa'at kishel magal, but it's not angled. The serrations are not angled as in the magal katsir, in the harvesting sickle.
Slanted.
Slanted, very good, thank you, that's a better word. Ela mechuvanot sheyesh lepekima morsha mikan umikan kistam pegimot ogeret umegira belaz saga. Again, it's the French. Shinayim hatechuvim belechi shel behema. So when it says teeth, these are teeth that are
still
in the jawbone of the animal. The hatziporin mechuberet. It's not a nail that is separated from the animal, but it's on the animal still, or on the foot of the animal. The shehen chonkin, because literally they choke. They choke. I translated it as tear. Still reading the Rashi. She'en chotchin ela korin nechamata pegimot. They do not slice, but rather they tear as a result of the serrations. V'hai chonkin ashara ka'ai v'lava tziporin. Well, he's going into the fact that the last one, the nails, don't actually fit the description here of the other ones so much. We'll have to define what the difference is between them. Okay, let's go to the Gemara. Have a little while, we can get into this a little bit. Now remember, the way this begins is Hashochet b'magal, the one who slaughters an animal with the blade of a hand sickle. Hashochet, and it was translated here, if one slaughters. It doesn't actually say that in the Hebrew, but it implies that, if one slaughters. The Eved in, that is to imply that we are talking about after the fact. After the fact, it's okay. The Eved in, lechatchila la, but not before the fact. In other words, you shouldn't do shchita with these things. But if you've done them with these things, and it's a kosher shechita, then it's all right. But we are not saying in this Mishnah that this is permissible. It's only after the fact that we don't disqualify it. Okay? Bishlama b'magal yad. This is understandable in the case of a hand sickle. Why? Because the hand sickle has two cutting edges. It could be that you make a mistake and that you use the wrong cutting edge. One of the cutting edges is serrated. The other cutting edge is simply sharp. And therefore, because you have two cutting edges, we don't want you to use this ab initio. Okay? But in fact, since one of the cutting edges is a permissible cutting edge, after the fact, it could be okay. So that we understand. But as far as a flint or a reed, is it really so that these should not be used for slaughter even in the first place? What's wrong with them? If they can be sharp, why can't you just use them in the first place? Why are they permissible only after the fact? Or a meaty. And now the Gemara brings an objection based on another source. Right? There is a contradiction from the following Baraita. Bakol Shochatin. Now, Bakol Shochatin is a different way of formulating the same idea. If we see Bakol Shochatin, that means it's okay to do it to begin with. With everything, one is permitted to perform Shechita. Bein Bitzor, Bein Bischuchit, Bein Bikrumit, Shel kana, whether it is with a flint, a glass, or a stem of a reed. Okay, so that contradicts what we understood from our Mishnah. And here it's okay to begin with. We understood the Mishnah to say it's only okay to after the fact. Bakasha. So the Gemara goes on and says, this is not difficult. It's not a problem. Kan betalush. In the Beraita's case, we're talking about implements detached from the ground. Kan bimechubar. Whereas in the case of the Mishnah, we're talking about things attached to the ground. D'amar Rav Kahana, as Rav Kahana says, Hashochet bimechubar lakarka. If you slaughter with an implement still attached to the ground, Rabbi Posel v'Rabbi Chiya Machshir, Rebbe invalidates the Shechita while Rabbi Chiya considers it valid. Ad kan lo kamachshir Rabbi Chiya ele b'dieved. And when Rabbi Chiya considers it okay, it's only after the fact. Aval lechatchila, but he didn't say that it was okay in the first place. Therefore, in fact, our Mishnah goes according to Rabbi Chiya. The Braita goes, the Braita is different. The Braita is different. Okay? Let's just see what this is saying. All right? How can it be attached to the ground? There are two principal possibilities here. First is the kane, the reed. And a reed can be attached to the ground. And it's much more unwieldy when it's attached to the ground. If we detach it, it in fact can function the way a knife does. If it remains attached to the ground, it's harder to handle. And therefore, it may be okay, but we don't want to use it ab initio. After the fact, it's okay. How about the flint? How can a flint be attached to the ground?
The animal against the flint, not the flint against the animal.
That's exactly right. A flint is a rock. It's simply a rock. You could have a rock, and you could have a sharp rock. You could even sharpen it up a little bit, and you could then move the animal against the flint rather than moving the flint against the animal. Exactly. Now, again, that's unwieldy. You have less control when you do something like that. But in fact, you might be able to do it okay. After the fact, we permit it, if we look at it and we see that everything is okay, all right. But we don't want people to go about it, about doing their shechita that way. You don't have enough control. But if the flint is separated, in fact, you use the flint just the way you use a knife, then it's permissible. Yes?
What happens if the animal just go to the reef and kills itself? Is it a nevela or is it a kosher shechita?
If the animal kills itself, it's a nevela. It's absolutely a nevela. Anything...
It was kosher shechita.
What kind of shechita? The only way you can have a...
It was kosher.
The animal
can... I mean, it's kosher. And it's kosher.
The only way you can have a kosher shechita is with a shochet.
With a hen.
With a person, and that person has to be a Jew. We saw that before, okay? So you cannot have a kosher shechita just by happenstance. It could be, we saw already that if a person throws a knife and it bounces off the wall, but there's still a person involved there, okay? But to do it without a person is not a shechita.
There's no martyrdom.
If there is, it's in a villa. To be continued.
Thank you. Have you ever seen a kosher wine?